into the the earliest reported incidents of a flying saucer, and I read that to you the way the computer analyzes that for you some night. But when we talk about a crashed flying saucer, my friend, we're talking about something you can touch and feel and see. And a lot of people have. And those are the people that have been talking to Leonard Stringfield, and Leonard is going to talk to you tonight. Leonard is with us. He's in Cincinnati. We have him on the long-distance line. We're so glad that you're up late tonight, Leonard, and are ready to talk to us about something I know that's taken up a lot of your time. Welcome to Open Mind.
Thank you, Bill. I have a very tall glass of water here in front of me with ice cubes. I'm all ready.
Well, I have a cup of coffee, so let's get into it. First of all, you have sent me two of your papers that you have written. The latest one being the UFO crash, retrieval syndrome, that's status 2, and earlier you had, what do we call that?
Well, the more recent paper, Bill, is the UFO crash retrieval syndrome. That's my status report number 2.
Right.
And the first was a paper that I delivered at the UFON Symposium in Dayton, Ohio, 1978. That was called Retrievals of the Third Kind.
Now, I have read these, and the first one was extremely interesting and quite vibrant. You had a lot of second and third-hand information there. But on the second one, your status 2 report, you're now dealing with first-hand information, so we're not dealing with hearsay as far as your interviewees are concerned, for the most part. And we'll get into some of the things and some of the incidents that they have talked about, but I want to put a question to you at the very front. The fact that there have been flying saucers that have crashed in the United States, and they have been manned by alien beings, and you have some vivid descriptions of them in your paper. Why has not the public been made more aware of this fact? Why do we find the government saying no comment about this?
Okay, Bill, I'd like to preface my revelations by saying that the whole thing is just an incredible story. Told by very credible people, and a story, in my opinion, so mind-boggling that it could change the lifestyle for peoples on Earth. And I believe if the whole story were properly told and confirmed by our government, it could conceivably unite the nations on Earth and end the threats of war and perhaps a nuclear holocaust.
I'm so glad you said that.
I think that my story must be heard by the man on the street, and seriously rationalized by professional people in the scientific community. Now, to get to your leading question here, the reasons for secrecy, if you will. Going back to 1953, there was an alleged CIA estimate of the situation. They referred to it that if this in one package were to reveal to the world public, it could create a cultural shock. Now, by that, my interpretation is that this would create a psychological reaction, perhaps like the one back in 1938 with Orson Welles' production. You would have some sort of initial shockwave, in my belief, although it is also my belief that that humanity could sustain this sort of information, because I think we have lived under stressful times since World War II, the threat of nuclear war, sociological behavior, what have you, all sorts of things, the Vietnam War. So I do believe that the public mind could adjust to such information. Now, number 2, another reason for secrecy, are some fears about the philosophical reaction. This, in my opinion, would affect some religious views on Earth. We have all sorts of religions, and some of them would be affected. They would have to undergo some change, I believe. And also would affect scientific status quo. And I think this would lead to economic reverberations. This would cause changes in our lifestyle and technology could have very drastic meaning in the energy area and affect our cartels. And it would certainly affect OPEC. So I think everything as we know it today would be changed by this type of information being distributed. It all depends how it would be distributed or released.
Mm-hmm.
Another area for secrecy is the technological area. This includes the replication of the propulsion system, energy, the metallurgical aspects of the craft, the anti-gravity system, and other abstract systems employing what I refer to as the psychomechanical or cybernetic devices. And of course, all of this sort of thing would be used in our space program and our military arsenal. So there would be ample reason for maintaining this in the highest degree of secrecy.
Well, you know, Leonard, I can understand the government wanted to keep secret whatever information that they might could find concerning propulsion systems and concerning weaponry and things of this nature. That I can readily agree with.
Yes.
But I cannot agree with the government looking at me and saying, you've got the mind of an 8-year-old and don't have sense enough to absorb this information that there are alien beings that are in our airspace, and I downright resent it if indeed that's a fact.
Yes.
I don't think it's their business. We have a government to serve us and not to tell us what to have to do any time we feel like it.
I heartily agree, and that's one reason for my endeavor in this area, is that I believe this information should be made public. That is, the fact that we do have the possibility of extraterrestrial visitation under constant surveillance, and we may not know the intent yet, but I believe the public should be informed of this matter, and it should have been a long time ago.
We're going to inform a lot of people about your findings tonight. We have a rather large audience, and it extends around the world through recorded versions of this show that are sent everywhere, so we'll spread the word a little bit. And I would like to spend a few moments with you, if I can, and let's go over some of the more startling case histories you have of a crash disk and what has happened with that craft and the people that have seen it, okay?
Yes, sir.
KABC time, 16 minutes past 10 o'clock.
Every day.
Guest tonight is Leonard H. Stringfield. He's speaking to us from Ohio, and he is the author of a couple of very penetrating and in-depth reports on this matter of crashed UFOs in the United States and how the government has dealt with them after that. Leonard, in all of the investigation you have done, what comes out as the paramount case, the one that strikes you the most so far?
Even above the cases, Bill, I would consider the information that I have received from a medical doctor who claims to have performed an autopsy on an alien body. That is not a particular case, but I mean, it's the information that I find so mind-boggling, so interesting. And this came to me last summer after about 6 months negotiation with one doctor at a certain hospital, which of course I'm not privileged to name for obvious reasons. I did receive a typewritten page of his general description of the body's anatomy, and this is published in my paper with his permission. However, as long as I didn't use his name or the hospital.
Right.
Now, I consider that to be very important because what he has relayed to me confirms what I have received from all the other sources, and I think this is very significant. Now, that area is an area of worthy of discussion and some time. Perhaps we'll do that a little later. But now when you get into the cases themselves, I do have now 12 first-hand witnesses, people who claim to have seen the bodies on a need-to-know basis and or the craft, the alien craft. These people are people who have served in military intelligence. One is a former CIA employee, and a couple are medical people. So I consider my informants to be above average people. These people who had served in the military intelligence capacity are now very, very normal citizens. They hold very respectable jobs. I have talked with them in person. I have every reason to believe them. I cannot believe that they are all conspiring to pull Stringfield, because I don't see any reason for that. So these are all independent sources who have come to me over a period of the last 2.5 years.
What did the doctor find in the autopsy of the body that he performed it on?
Well, Bill, I can read you his statement, if you don't mind. That may take about a minute. Is it okay?
That's certainly fine.
All right, that's a good starting point. Okay, I'll just go ahead and read this right from my paper. Just a second, I'll get to that section here.
All right.
Here we are. Quote, the specimen observed was 4 feet 3 and 3/8 inches in length. I can't remember the weight. It has been so long my files do not contain the weight. I recall the length well because we had a a disagreement, everyone took their turn at measuring. The head was pear-shaped in appearance and oversized by human standards for the body. The eyes were mongoloid in appearance. The ends of the eyes, furthest from their nasal cavity, slanted upward at about a 10-degree angle. The eyes were recessed into the head. There seemed to be no visible eyelids, only what seemed like a fold. The nose consisted of a small fold-like protrusion above the nasal orifices. The mouth seemed to be a wrinkle-like fold. There were no human-type lips as such, just a slit that opened into an oral cavity about 2 inches deep. The membrane along the rear of the cavity separated it from what would be the digestive tract. Tongue seemed to be atrophied into almost a membrane. No teeth were observed. X-rays revealed a maxilla and mandible as well as a cranial bone structure. The outer earlobes didn't exist. The auditory orifices present were similar to our middle and inner ear canals. The head contained no hair follicles. The skin seemed grayish in color and seemed mobile when moved. The above observations are from general anatomical observations. I didn't autopsy or study the head portion in any great detail, since this was not my area of specialty. And he goes on to say, note, your drawing of the head, which of course I had sent to him, should have cheekbones removed or a smoother contour. The eyes in the nasal cavity are not right. The recess and fold is continuous across the cord. The neck seems too long, but the shoulders do not slope as prominently. This may give you this effect. The arms are oversized in length by human standards. There was no thumb. The index finger you're drawing is longer than the middle finger. I don't believe this is correct, but my memory is hazy at this point. The chest area contained what seemed like two atrophied mammary gland nipples. The sexual organs were atrophied. Some other investigators have observed female specimens. They have not had this opportunity. The legs were short and thin. The feet didn't show any toes. The skin covered the foot in such a way that it gave the appearance of wearing a sock. However, x-ray examination showed normal bone structure underneath. Now that was the note that I received from the medical person, but that was not being construed as being a part of an autopsy report.
Right.
This is just a general statement that I could use in my paper. So it's a generalization. Now, I have received, of course, other information from the doctor at different points in time, and information from other medical people and other people who have seen these bodies firsthand, and it goes a little beyond his statement, but it's all tied together. In other words, the witnesses I have are all saying just about the same thing, and these are independent witnesses, I must stress. Now, Bill, should we go on and then get a rundown when I have the general information? You want to do that after another commercial or what?
Well, we'll just keep on going here, but I do remember, as I read your report here, that you have a number of people who have, from time to time, seen these bodies being held in cryogenic suspension at various military bases around the country, and does their observation of what they have seen seem to all gel? Are we seeing something that all of these independent people who don't have any crosstalk are reporting to you?
That's right. Yes, they're all saying the same thing. And again, a quick rundown, the height the body averages from all witnesses runs around 3.5 to 4.5 feet. The weight is about 40 pounds. There are two round eyes, described as brown, under a heavy brow ridge. And of course, I mentioned the fact that they have an oriental or mongoloid appearance.
Right.
The doctor later told me that to get a better understanding of the general anatomy or configuration of the body is to take a look at a 5-month-old human fetus. And now, in my paper, I have a drawing. Rear of the paper showing my interpretation of what he related to me, and that's interesting. Again, about the ears, there are no earlobes, no nose, but there are nares. The mouth is a slit, with a small slit. The leash is nowhere, it's only a membrane, about 2 inches in recess. And the mouth does not function as a means of communication, or as an orifice for food ingestion, and that's very significant. So there's no GI tract. The body and head is described as being hairless. Now, significant to me is the hand. I do have a drawing of the hand, which was used also by a former CIA employee as well as the doctor and other people. They're all saying the same thing, but it has four fingers and no thumb.
Mm-hmm.
With a slight webbing effect between each appendage or finger. Now, this to me is very significant. It tells a lot of things. In the legs are short and thin. I do have a variant of the description of the foot. One of my observers claimed it looked like an orangutan. Others claim that just a slight showing of visible toes and a mass of small bones inside the foot. This shows evolutionary regression, according to one comment from the doctor. Now, I'd like to emphasize here, this is very important. The skin is not green.
No.
This is what they've been getting away with for years. Oh, you mean you're referring to little green men?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that's one way of putting the whole thing down. Well, they are not green. The general description is ashen in color or light tan or gray. The emphasis seems to be in the various tones of gray, depending on the condition of the body. In some cases, the bodies were retrieved in a burned or mangled condition.
Right.
Now, under light, sometimes the lights for the maintainer or cryogenic preservation or deep freeze, such as Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, thought appear to be bluish gray. The skin itself is sort of scaly or reptilian, very stretchable or elastic over skeletal tissue. There is no striated muscle, and according to another medical informant, there is no perspiration or body odor.
Are we seeing the same kind of alien beings, or are there different types?
I understand, yes. It's a good question. When I brought this up before one of the doctors, I showed a variant in the description. He said, well, of course, you have to consider the fact there's more than one type. Well, how many types there are, frankly, I don't know. I have not been able to elicit that an answer to that question from my sources. But apparently there are a number of types or species.
A little later on, Wendell Stevens will join us tonight, who probably is one of the most thorough UFO investigators in the world. And I think you know Wendell, or you talked
to him. Yes, I know Wendell very. In fact, I talked to him just very recently.
Yes.
Another thing, Bill, for everyone out there that's wondering how they get a hold of this paper, they say in one of the TV commercials, I urge everyone to get a pencil and paper in hand.
Go right ahead and do it.
And I can give you the address where the paper can be obtained. If it's okay now, Bill?
Yeah, go ahead and do it.
All right. The paper costs $5. I believe it's worth it's a nicely done paper. It cost quite a bit to publish it. It was published by MUFON. That's the Mutual UFO Network. And you can use the word MUFON. The address is 103 Old Town Road. That's one word, Old Town. That is in Seguin, Texas. S-E-G-U-I-N, Texas. The zip code is 78155. The paper was just recently released. I'd like to add one note here that because of the sensitivity of this subject, I'm turning all proceeds, if any money is involved, all proceeds will go to UFO research.
Very good. I'm glad you said that.
So I think that's very important. The paper is 38 pages long. It's in 8-10 point type, and if we were then the usual typeface would be twice that size, and it doesn't include drawing. I think it's well worth the $5.
It's fascinating reading. I've got one right in front of me. Before we break away here for just a second, I wanted to tell you that I tried to reach young Bill Herman, who was the guest on our very first Open Mind program, who has evidently had personal relations with people who seem to match the description of the people you're describing so often. But Bill just doesn't seem to be available. He's not answering. But after we get back, there is a young man, and we'll just call him David, on the telephone, who is a contact of yours and who has had a personal experience with this matter of crash disk himself. He will join us, okay?
Very good.
All right. You're listening to Bill Jenkins. This is the Open Mind program on KABC in Los Angeles. Our subject is crashed disk, or the crashed UFOs, the retrieval of them and the occupants of them and what the government is doing with them. And we're wondering just why they're keeping it so secret. But we have a lot of things to talk about. Stay with.
Oh, what's...
Yes, indeed. UFOs have crashed in the United States of America. They have been taken by the government to various military installations and studied, as well as the people on board. Our guest tonight is Leonard H. Springfield, who's one of the finest investigative journalists in the country and an author. First book was Situation Red, and he has written two fine papers about this matter of UFOs that have crashed. His latest is the UFO Crash Retrieval Syndrome Status 2, in which he'll bring you up to date in that paper on first-hand reports of people that in one way or another have been involved with that. And joining us tonight is a young man we're going to just call David. And David himself has had his own experiences with this matter. David, welcome to Open Mind. Are you there?
Yes, Bill. How are you this evening?
I'm very fine. We want to keep your name anonymous. I know that you have a little bit of problem with the fact that you were involved with it, and Leonard Springfield is here. Leonard, you on?
Yes, David. How are you?
Fine, Mr. Springfield. How are you?
Just fine. Very good.
David, would you mind touching on your experience with this matter of crash disk for us?
Well, I believe, Bill, you probably received some papers, and when I had first talked to you a couple of days ago on the phone, I had mentioned that I wasn't sure whether I could or could not get in contact with you.
Yes.
So the information is there, and you have it, and Leonard has it.
Right.
Mr. Springfield, over the last few days, received some papers from me, and he's aware of what's going on. So really, I don't want to get too much involved in it at this end right now, Bill, and I'm sure you can understand that. I want to just basically say that for the listening audience that's out there, and Mr. Springfield and I have been working together for about the last year and a half, and I would like your audience to know that Mr. Springfield is one of the few men that is probably, as far as being able to keep confidential information confidential, I have the highest regard and the highest respect for Mr. Springfield, number one. And number two, I'd like Mr. Springfield to maybe go over briefly, if he can, something that probably thousands of your listeners are unaware of. And that's something I believe known as the Blue Berets. Is that correct, Mr. Springfield?
Yeah, the Blue Berets. We were certainly going to get to them. Leonard?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, the question was, do you want to go ahead and tell the audience about the Blue Berets?
I didn't hear what the is.
Well, David suggested that perhaps you would like to bring the audience up to date on this activity of the government that's going on, and which we just call the Blue Berets, and what they do.
Oh, the Blue Berets. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Well, that's a nickname for a specialized unit in the military, like the Green Berets.
Mm-hmm.
And they are made up for retrieval operations. Now, that includes, of course, military retrievals behind enemy lines. They were very active in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever one of our aircraft crashed behind enemy lines, it was their job to go behind the lines and retrieve both the pilot and the craft if possible. They perform all sorts of secret missions. Now, that would include the retrieval of the downed or crashed alien craft. They have been, is my understanding, they have been involved in retrievals of the craft. And the nickname is Blue Beret. And I've been fortunate to talk to a former member of the Blue Berets, and he himself was never involved directly in a retrieval operation, but one of his cohorts has been involved and explained that he was unable to say where this occurred, but apparently somewhere in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But what this unit can do in order to maintain their secret operation, to go in and be able to get the object, is to perform all sorts of digressional moves. They can create a blackout in a small area or a city in order to do their thing, or other diversionary tactics in order to get in to retrieve the craft. They do have the authority to go in and make all sorts of moves, to cordon off areas, to bring to work with the local sheriff, the police department, or whatever who may be involved. So they are a part, they have been a covert part of the operation going back many years.
Mr. Jenkins?
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible then, I don't know if Mr. Springfield can hear me back there on the line, is it possible that, directing this question to Mr. Springfield, is it possible that a lot of the things we see happening in our news, or some of the things we see happening in our news, are really not happening, but diversionary tactics by this force?
You mean the current news in other areas? I really don't know, how far their authority goes. I do know that the Blue Berets, so-called, have been dissolved in recent years. There are new units who do this work, but I do not know the nickname of the new unit. But
As far as being in the news or in other areas, now, I suppose they could be very useful in Iran right now, and retrieving our hostages, that would be a useful area, wouldn't it?
Be nice. All right. So the Blue Berets have been rather active, and...
Yes, over the past years.
And you feel that they've been very active in this matter of retrieving crashed UFOs, perhaps the ones that we had a number of them evidently in Kentucky, Tennessee, in that area for a while.
Yes, they have the ability by the quickest means getting into an area where something had reportedly crashed. Of course, our NORAD system can pick up and detect when a UFO or a saucer, if you will, is in trouble. They have ways of detecting that. So they're in a position to pinpoint the area where the probable crash will occur, which will allow ample time for the specialists to get in there to do their thing. So that's how so often that they can get in there ahead of the public and to close off an area. And when the public becomes too aroused or gets too close, why they're chased away or other things happen.
Well, the general scenario, then, as I read it from your paper, UFO Crash Retrieval Syndrome, is that if we can detect when one of these things is in trouble and it crashes, we get a military group in there rather quickly. And then a number of different people are sent in secrecy to that group and are allowed to only deal with it in terms of their own expertise, whether they are involved in guarding it, the vehicle and its occupants, or if they are a scientist or a metallurgist or something. They see only little bits and pieces of the craft, never the whole thing all at the same time.
That's correct. Yes, their area of expertise is highly segmented, and they are not permitted to see the overall. If it's in the area of metallurgy or whatever, medical, those people do their thing, and they go about their business, and they're not allowed to hold conversation between each other.
David, do you have any comments on that? I certainly don't want to infringe upon... the status that you want to take there, but is that pretty much your experience with it?
Well, I was unaware of the Blue Berets themselves until Mr. Trinkle and I started passing documents back and forth, and I was wondering, you know, as these things that have been hidden over, we're talking about here now, 40-year period. Just how this was done, and a force like this just seems extremely logical. And I was just wondering, if the force was still in existence, and since Mr. Trinkle said it was discontinued, I wonder how, either now or in the future, how situations like this are still being able to be hidden.
I imagine that it's evolved into something perhaps a little more sophisticated, David, that basically does the same job, however.
Yes, that's my understanding. There are new units with a new code name or a new name that to me has not been identified, but I'm certain that there are specialized units who can get in to do their thing, yes, on a national or international basis.
Both of you stand pat for just a second. We're 16 minutes of 11 o'clock. I'm Bill Jenkins talking to Leonard H. Stringfield, who is the author of UFO Crash, the Retrieval Syndrome, Status 2, and that is a rather in-depth look at this matter of crashed UFOs and the alien beings found on board. Most of them were no longer living at the time. A few of them lived for a while. We want to get into that story for you. And also remind you that we would like to talk to you. If you'd like to talk to our guest, we have a young man named David on it. That's not his real name, but he does not want to reveal it. He's been involved with this himself. The number in Los Angeles to call is 520-TALK. In the San Fernando Valley, you can call us at 981-7900. In Orange County, the number is 638-5151. In Burbank, the number to call is 244-0790. In the San Gabriel Valley, the number to call is 579-5986. In the South Bay area, the number is 644-0790. And down in Compton, Lakewood, Long Beach, Linwood, that area, you can call us at 639-2036. This is Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins.
They swore they never returned.
Hi, this is Leonard H. Stringfield, who is... an investigative reporter of the First Order, and he has been dealing a great deal into this matter of crashed UFOs in the United States and the government secrecy surrounding them, and we're trying to figure out why. And we're opening up our lines now to Leonard. We have a number of stories to tell you, but we want to get some of the questions from you. Leonard, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
And young David is with us, who voluntarily called in with us tonight.
Bill?
Yes.
If there's time, I'd like for David to recount just a little briefly his experience in seeing a disabled craft on the ground in Fort Riley, Texas. Also of interest, I have a source, a very reliable source, a former CIA employee who backed up that story. He didn't give me any information concerning the incident, but he did back up the incident. I think that's very important, plus the fact that I have another source who did back up David's story. So if he does have time a little later, he might recount it very briefly.
Well, David, if you want to, why don't you go ahead now?
Okay, Bill.
Okay.
Well, in 1964, I was stationed in the Army in Fort Riley, Kansas, which is located right about in the center of the state.
Mm-hmm.
On the night of December 10th, 1964, or the morning of the 10th, I had a regular guard duty assignment guarding the motor pool in an area of the fort. Fort Riley is broken down into like five sections. Well, Camp Funston, Main Post, Camp Foresight. And anyway, on this particular night, I was guarding a section of the motor pool in Camp Foresight. Guard duty was 2 hours on, 4 hours off. Around 1 a.m. on the morning of the 10th of December, 1964, I was be relieved. And a lieutenant came up to me and, brought the Jeep up into the motor pool area, got into the Jeep, and he started driving away from the barracks where the guard slept. And we started going into the back roads of the Fort Riley area. I estimated we drove maybe for about 20, 25 minutes or so, and he told me to get out of the Jeep. I went to this truck, and standing behind the truck were two other enlisted men, specialist fourth class, and another PFC, and also a number of officers. And yeah, I have to backtrack here for a few seconds. On regular guard duty in Fort Riley, Kansas, we were only given 3 rounds of ammunition. That's all, 7.62 NATO rounds for the M14 that we used at that time. We were given a full clip of ammunition, each one of us, from the back of the truck.
Mm.
And we were told that a secret aircraft from Offutt Air Force Base, which was located in Nebraska, the next state up, had become disabled, and we were to put a security net around it, and the object was top secret, a classified object. From where this truck was, we hiked up and down about 3 or 4 hills, so that was about another 25 to 45 minutes, I'm estimating. And it was quite dark, and we really didn't know what was happening. I mean, we're half asleep, and all I wanted to do was go back to bed. All of a sudden, we heard like a thrashing sound, like a... Turned out that thrashing sound was a Huey-type helicopter with a very, very tremendous bright beam on it. You know how the police here in the L.A. area look for criminals with a beam?
Sure do.
But it was much, much more intense, maybe 3 or 4 times brighter. Anyway, this chopper would go back and forth over this semi-flat terrain, and all of a sudden it lit up this round, disc-shaped object. And I stood back about that time. I would estimate we were maybe about 100 to 150 feet away. And I said, my God, the thing looks like a flying saucer, jokingly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we got right up to it. We walked around it. That would be about probably around an hour. Now, during this hour, the Huey helicopter would go back and forth over the field, or the terrain area there. The light would constantly be scanning the ground back and forth. It would come over the top of the object, 60 to 200 feet above the object, hover over it, light it up, then fly off. This went on approximately an entire hour I was there. The craft, and this was going back quite a few number of years, the craft was about roughly, like a hamburger bun with like the meat sticking out of the middle. But it wasn't a hamburger. It was like little squares that were jutting out from it, kind of the appearance of hard rubber. For lack of a better word, it had a fin or a port on it. Below that was a round type opening, which I'm calling an exhaust port. I really don't know what it was. When you got real close to this thing, by real close, I'm saying within 7 inches to maybe 25 or 30 inches. The air was definitely warmer, and you could feel that. It was very, very cold that night. Eventually, a 5-ton truck came there. Some radio equipment was set up. Other men came around there, around the area. And we were told to leave, that we were no longer needed there. This was at the time at around 3 a.m. in the morning. So the original, myself and the original men that were by that deuce and a half truck were marched back to the deuce and a half truck. And we were told never to reveal or repeat what we saw there that night, because that object definitely was a secret object from off of Air Force Base. And to this day, going back to what I saw and photos that I have seen since that date, leads me to an awful lot of speculation that what I saw that night was not, quote, unquote, a secret object.
Hey, David?
Plus, why, if that thing was paid with taxpayers' dollars in 1964, why hasn't it been revealed in 1980 or 1979?
You provoke a lot of questions, and let's get back to those in just a moment, shall we? Well, we're letting you know about it tonight, or at least giving you some information that seems to be of merit, at least to listen to and weigh. My guest tonight is Leonard H. Stringfield, who is an excellent investigative journalist who has checked around the country on this over and over again. No telling how many hours Leonard has spent on that, talking to people who have been involved in the process that has gone on for many years now of retrieving crashed UFOs and their occupants. And we also have a surprise guest, a young man who did, in fact, guard one of these out in Kansas some time ago. He is on the line. And we're ready now to continue our conversation with Leonard. Leonard, before we get into letting you field some calls from our callers and from the audience out there, is there any other thing that you'd like to mention to? There are a number of stories we can get into, and we will during the course of the
evening. All right. Well, I think, first of all, Bill, and I'm sure that the curiosity has been aroused out there where to get the paper. So
let's do that again, yes.
The title of the paper is The UFO Crash Retrieval Syndrome. That's quite a mouthful. But if you write for the paper, just mention status report number 2, which was published by the Mutual UFO Network, and the initials are MUFON. The address is 103 Old Town Road, that's one word, Old Town Road, that is in Seguin, Texas, S-E-G-U-I-N, Texas, zip code 78155. And again, I'd like to stress that there is no profit on this paper. This is a non-profit research organization. The Mutual UFO Network is an international research organization. They took upon themselves to publish the paper at their expense, and that all proceeds have been turned over to research on my end. So I'm not receiving a nickel on it. That's the way it should be, because it creates very sensitive material. It should be made public.
Well, I'm glad you brought that out, Leonard, and I can say that it's a fascinating paper. And that's the reason you're on the air tonight with us here on the Open Mind program. You ready to go to our callers? They can be really, really tough on us. Okay, KABC, you're on with Bill Jenkins and Leonard Stringfield.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, this is Mel from the San Fernando Valley, Bill.
Yes, Mel.
And I find your program extremely interesting. I'm a researcher, independent researcher, and a little bit of a scholar. There's a couple of questions that come to my mind I'd like to present to your guest, Leonard and David, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
I've been extremely interested in this UFO phenomena, which I call it, for about 25 years. A very imaginative young man handed me a book about 25 years ago just simply called UFOs. And, of course, this book went into many different aspects of phenomena, unexplainable phenomena, and of which UFOs was a part of the book. But what's been bothering me a little bit is that, number one, I was wondering, now, has there been a sequence of crashes like in the last 20 years? And what is the most recent date of a known crash?
Okay, the first known crash, to my knowledge, occurred back in 1947 in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And to my knowledge, there have been about 13 crashes. These are incidents that I have had the opportunity to investigate or talk to people who were aware of these crashes.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Now, they are not, it's sort of a rare thing when you consider the number of UFOs that have been seen by the thousands over the many years since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking in terms of 12 or 13 crashes. That's not too often.
Mm-hmm.
However, my figure is this may be the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. There may have been many, many more.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have occurred overseas. This is not strictly the United States, and I think that should be emphasized.
Which may be one of the reasons.
The most recent possible crash, I'm unable to get details at this time, occurred in Australia just a couple months ago.
I see.
Now, I have no details on that one. But, again, there was a crash in, on the Bolivian-Argentine border on the Atacama Mountain back in May of 1978. There was also an incident that occurred in Ohio, where if the story is correct, I had been unable to back this one up with any first-hand informants. This occurred in an area called, it's a rural region called Lumberton, where allegedly a craft had been disabled, and a military team had been dispatched to the area. And it's my understanding there was quite a melee or some disorder that occurred there that resulted in some casualties on our side as well as the other. But the source of this information is in Pennsylvania, and the investigator or two investigators who were involved in trying to elicit more information were unable. They ran into a very hard door. The man with the information, the first-hand informant, just wouldn't come forward and discuss the matter any further. So I have been unable to penetrate that one.
I see.
And I can understand why that one would be hushed, because if there were casualties involved.
Leonard, are you saying the casualties were brought on by some sort of a confrontation between...
Yes, there was apparently a confrontation of the type. Yes. I've been unable to get any additional details. According to my very reliable investigator, my informant, why I have every reason to believe these people. But I understand that the first-hand informant has become very elusive and just won't talk.
I think it might be well, Leonard, to point out, too, that not only have there been crashes, but you have in your latest paper an incident that happened at Nellis Air Force Base where there was just an out-and-out landing.
Yes. Well, now, there have been a number of landings on Air Force bases. There was one on Ellis Air Force Base in Nevada. I understand there was a landing at the Edwards Air Force Base many years ago. I have numerous reports of landings on sensitive installations, including air bases. One on White Sands.
Can I interject here for one second?
And some of the information I received from some very good informants. They're a little sensitive about the material, and in some instances, I'm unable to relay anything based on the informant's request. And this, of course, is understandable.
Yes.
But I keep working at it, and those who have surfaced to relate information to me, why I feel very privileged with this information. In fact, I feel freakish with it at times, because what can I really do with it? And the bad thing about it, Bill, is that it is, to an extent, hearsay that I can't, in most instances, name or identify my source. Because of the sensitivity, these people have been under oath, and they do desire privacy. And you can imagine what would happen to them if their names were suddenly revealed to the media, that they would lose all sense of privacy, and also be subject to punitive measures. So, in no way will I transgress these people who have given me very valuable information.
Yeah. Of course not.
And that's unfortunate, because it'd be beautiful if I could come up with a whole fistful of affidavits.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, at that time, it's not now, and hopefully in the future, it may be.
Well,
but I'm continually getting new sources since the publication of this paper, Bill. I have 7 new informants, mind you, which could lead to some very... eventually some very valuable information.
If I could just have just a couple more seconds. Now, there is one more thing. Am I speaking... This is Leonard.
Leonard Stringfield, yes.
Yes, yes, Leonard. Now, there's something that sort of bothers me, though. Now, evidently, these people, they have to travel over a large distance to reach us. Is this correct now, or is this the assumption that these people are coming from a...
Yes, these crashes occur in random areas, often requiring distance for the troops or whatever to get in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, now, what concerns me is that if these people, and we have to, I think we almost have to assume that they have... reached a technological level to where they can travel these fast distances. Now, it seems to me that, you know, that by now, if, say, the first few did crash or something happened, they weren't familiar with our particular conditions here on this planet.
Yes.
But it seems to me that somehow they would have got communication back to their kinsmen or something.
Yes.
You know, and these crashes wouldn't keep occurring. Now this bothers me. Now I'm not trying to put any
yes.
any holes in your research. Believe me, because I've like I say, I'm somewhat of a scholar, and I've went pretty heavy into math and so forth. But this does bother me. And do you have any kind of an explanation for that?
Is your question now concerning the vast
yes, my question. My question is this: that it seems to me that if they possess the technology to travel these vast distances
yes.
to reach us here, that they certainly would have navigation equipment that is far superior, probably, to anything that we know right
yes.
now. And it seems to me that these crashes, certainly could be avoided, especially if their craft is equipped with, some type of
yes.
gravitation devices or something.
Yeah, well, I considered that, too. And I think that anything, like anywhere, whether it's from this galaxy or another galaxy or wherever, and no matter how sophisticated it may be,
mm-hmm.
Everything is subject to error.
This is true.
To making a mistake. And I think that I think that would include any extraterrestrial.
Mm-hmm.
They're all subject to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
If the machine is cybernetically controlled,
yes.
Computers are subject to making errors. I know ours do.
Yes.
And I have every reason to believe that anyone out there would be subject to mistakes. They may make less of them.
Well, I doubt we can get
I would like to add this. Now, since World War II, that's been many, many years in the past, if we only have perhaps 12 to perhaps two dozen crashes in all those years
mm-hmm.
with the
mm-hmm.
numerous flights that have
yes.
been reported. But that's actually a small number.
Mm-hmm.
So the number of crashes are seemingly small or rare considering the overall surveillance.
Mr. Greenfield?
Yes.
Yes.
This is David on the line here.
Oh, yeah. Maybe as opposed to human error, maybe we can coin a new term and call that humanoid error.
Yes.
Well, if I may, there, gentlemen, if I can jump in there for Mel and the rest of them, I think we have Wendell Stevens on the line. Wendell, you there? Hello, Wendell.
Yes, sir. You do, sir.
Mel was wondering why the crashes are there. These are very advanced in their technology. What's going wrong? And it seems like
yes.
we had discussed that before, that maybe radar or something was one of
them. Well, there's another thought here, too. Yes, I've heard that radar, electrical storms, atmospheric conditions, computer error, but there's one other thought. This information has been coming to me here from various sources, and again, it's hypothetical, but magnetic grid network encompassing the Earth's sphere, and this may account for the UFO's flight pattern, east to west, north to south, and so forth, and in some rare instances cause abortive behavior or the crashes. Now this is a magnetic grid system which is encompassing the Earth's sphere. Now I won't go into that because that requires a lot of technical explanation that's beyond my knowledge, but this seems to account for some of the error in their flight behavior.
Do you have anything to add to that, Wendell, before we go on?
Well, the one case that I was working with over in South Carolina, Bill Herman, I believe you had him on the program one time.
Yes, I did try to get him on tonight, but he wasn't answering.
Oh, yeah. Where the alien entities mentioned to him that one of their craft was damaged by a certain kind of radar that was used in, it was nose lock-on radar used on fighter aircraft several years ago that they had a ship go out of control because they calculated later because the radar locked on it and it stayed on long enough to upset the autopilot system or the computer system that ran the craft. And that caused them some problems.
So there's always error there, Mel. It can happen to everybody, and including our friends from space.
Okay.
All right, Mel, thank you very much.
You're on the Open Mind program. I'm Bill Jenkins. Our subject tonight is crashed UFOs in the United States and the retrieval process that goes on. My guest, most investigators of the UFO phenomena. And we have a young man also on the line who is
decided to stay with us, and we're glad he has, who was involved in guarding one of these crashed UFOs, an eyewitness to the incident. So let's get on back to it and to our callers. KABC, you're on with Bill Jenkins in the Open Mind program.
Hello, this is Louis.
Hello, Louis.
Say, I was just wondering, your description a few minutes ago of what you saw kind of meshes with something that I saw on a very special maneuver that was conducted at Camp Ripley, Minnesota in 64, about June. I was with the National Guard out there in Wichita, Kansas, and I think it was the 32nd Division was what they called it out there. They took us all up to Camp Ripley in a great big convoy, and one moonless night out there, they had us dig in, and we were told to stay in place, that they were going to attempt to attack us, some special assault groups were, and they were very weird, I thought, very unusual the way they gave us instructions. They told us under no circumstances were we to move. They gave us a lot of instruction in the use of visual purple and night vision training by looking out of the corner of our eyes, and they told us to notify our immediate superior even if we went to the pit latrine that they had dug out there. And after a few hours of darkness, a little after midnight, I got kind of tired of just sitting in one place. And I went back to the latrine, and then, I don't know, I guess I was kind of bored. I took my rifle, and I went for about 25 or 30 feet, and I thought I heard something. And so I just stuck down where I was. I didn't want to get in any trouble since they've given us such harsh instructions about moving. My legs had been kind of cramped earlier, and I wanted to stretch out for just a few paces and then go back to my foxhole there. But when I ducked down beside these bushes, I noticed a guy was walking very close to me that had a different kind of a uniform than I did. He had a different kind of a helmet. He had something he was holding in his hand that looked like it was a sighting device of some type where he was able to see through the darkness better than I was. And so I followed this guy for a little while. His weapon looked different than mine. It didn't look like a submachine gun would have looked, and it was smaller. And I thought, this is kind of an unusual guy. If he's the aggressor, there's no use in my just letting him go on, towards our communications gear. So I followed him for a little while, and I think a couple of times he was pretty well on to the fact that I was following him, but being an old country boy, he just didn't quite nail me down. Every time he turned around and looked at me, I managed to duck down and keep myself between the shrubbery and him. But I followed him, I'd say for a good 300 meters, and then I noticed that his footprints, which evidently I could see a little bit in the light. There was no moon, and his footprints just kind of ended at, I would say, a tree that was about 35 feet high. And when his prints ended, I thought, oh no, I really blew it now. This guy's probably sitting right on top of me in the tree. But before I started to look up at the tree, I noticed that the air was warmer. And I noticed there was some kind of a gentle downdraft. And when I started to look up, I noticed something else that startled me almost immediately, where there had been no clouds before, and we at least had the starlight. All of a sudden, I realized that there was no starlight over me. Our stars were blocked out by some sort of a rather large object, and so I moved my eyes around rather quickly, to see if I could frame this thing. It was obviously a black object, and when I checked around the top of me, I noticed that it was circular, and doggone if I didn't hear a metal door slide away, and I looked up. There was a square door in the center of this thing, and I could hear sort of an electronic whining sound, one like you'd hear with possibly with hydraulic equipment running, but I'm only guessing.
Luke, can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
This is David. This was in Kansas now?
Well,
in which, can you remember the year?
I was in that National Guard unit out
year?
There that they have on, it's the one south of town there. We were in the old 32nd Division, and they moved us in a big convoy.
What town was it in, or what area, what state?
Well, they moved us up to Camp Ripley, Minnesota for this maneuver.
So this happened in Minnesota?
Yeah, this happened on a moonless night there, after they had to give us a bunch of training in night vision.
What year?
It was 64, I believe, June, or I believe it was about June of 64. And this object that I looked up and saw bore a very strong resemblance to the one that he said he was guarding. And that's why it kind of shocked me when I sat here and was listening to what he said. Also, the way that I noticed the warm air near it, and when I was under it, sort of a downward, very, very gentle, warm air current. The only thing is that I don't know whether he was under it or not. I would say that I probably saw the same vehicle, but I was under it, and it was painted black, or was black. And but the thing about it was that this square door under on the bottom side of it slid away, and then I could hear the sort of an electronic equipment sound whine. There was no motor noise at any time.
Did you see it fly away, or was that just it? It was above you.
Well, no. I fell backwards then. I was so startled by the whole thing, I fell backwards on the ground, and I was laying there with my rifle looking up at this thing. And the square door, they had red blackout lights in it. I could hear a couple of voices talking, but I couldn't really make out that much what they were saying. I would estimate that they were somewhere around, probably 38 feet or 40 feet above me. And it was a big object. I mean, it was not
What size was this being that you saw?
This
is Les Stringfield.
The man appeared to me to be a soldier with special equipment, the likes of which I've never seen before. The only thing is that years later, I saw a Mechanics Illustrated story on the Turbo Soldier and also the old-style radio helmet, the one that was shaped differently with the antenna in the top. And when I saw those pictures of some of their experimental gear that they had in that regard, and the later on when they made it plain that they had the night vision scope, it was obvious to me then that this is what the guy was carrying. But now, let me tell you what happened. I really felt like at this point I was in over my head, and I'd already violated orders by walking away from where they had me stationed. So I got the hell out of there and got back to where I was supposed to be. But the next morning, they had my whole unit up. They had us standing at attention in the sun for somewhere a little over 3 hours. They were screaming at us, wanting to know who it was that left their post, who it was that had followed this guy. They reminded us that there was classified operations taking place. We were told not to leave our post. And I don't know, the way they handled it, the way they asked their questions, it was so frightening that for 4 years I wouldn't even talk to my best buddies in the National Guard unit. I wouldn't even admit I had done it. But they narrowed it down to where they were sure that it was one of three of us that had followed this guy. He just looked like an average height being to me. I'm 6 foot. He seemed a little smaller, but he didn't seem small enough for me to notice. I was certain beyond the shadow of a doubt later on when I was looking for ways to explain it. You know, I guess everyone tries to justify what they see. Later on, I read an article about some of their secret work in quiet copters that there's been a little bit of talk about, and I thought, well, if it was a quiet copter, I could understand it, but there just wasn't any engine noise other than just a faint whine of maybe hydraulic or like generating gear.
I'll interrupt you just a second here. I know you don't have the time to go into a full explanation, and nor would I have time to ask a lot of questions now, but would it be possible if you could send me a report on this to my home address and your phone number, and I could be in touch with you?
I tell you, well, we have all of the information on Louis here for you, okay?
Okay.
Leonard, and I'll send it on to you.
All right. I would like to be able to be in touch with this gentleman and discuss it further. I have some questions which I wouldn't want to put over the air.
But anyway, I wanted to say one thing to you before we cut it off. It's been my firm opinion since this incident happened that, and since I saw the later on articles about this experimental military gear that was not adopted in the way of the helmet and all, and which is actually what I saw that night, this guy wearing, I have felt like that this was in the inventory, and I had felt like it was on the order of a quiet copter. But there's other things about it that just didn't quite add up. It's been a long time ago. I don't remember all the details now, I'm sure, as well as I did then. But let me tell you, the last remark that was made to me by somebody who was identified as a United States Army intelligence officer, when they had me in for... You are the one that followed that guy, aren't you? He said, you are the one that was over there out of position. He said, I feel like it's you. But he said, we really can't prove whether it's you or one of these other two guys. But he said, personally, I believe it is you.
Lou, is that your name?
Lou, yes.
Yeah. Lou and Mr. Greenfield?
Yeah.
Isn't it true, back a number of years ago, Donald E. Kehoe was saying that all the major corporations, Northrop, McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, Lockheed, and many other military-based companies had tremendous contracts, if I recall, from the government on anti-gravity devices. Isn't that true?
Yes, they were all working at it, but we had been unable to learn how successful.
That's kind of interesting, yeah. Listening to Louis.
And that goes back many back in the 50s. But again, whatever they've come up with, of course, would remain top secret.
Can I make a remark that might
there's
be...
There's no question that we have been trying to develop a replica of this, the prototype, the original, the extraterrestrial device.
I tell you what, time's getting away from us here just a little bit.
All right.
Louis, I'm going to pass your telephone number and things along to Mr. Springfield, and he can talk to you more, you know, off the air about this. Would that be all right?
Yeah, can I make one last quick remark to you there?
Yeah,
I worked over at Pacific Aeromotive at the Hollywood Burbank Air Terminal, and a number of times there I saw vertical takeoff planes leave, and they always kind of did it on a moonless night, you know, when it was dark. Sometimes the only thing you'd see would just be one nav light on. But one night there, I noticed on one of their vertical takeoff planes when I was in my car at the parking lot at Pacific Aeromotive, I noticed leaving from one of the Lockheed buildings, one of their vertical takeoff planes took off almost without noise. Very similar to the sound that this thing made. And it didn't get very high at all until it was just almost inaudible. And I really kind of suspect that this is something that they had a few prototypes in the inventory of. I really believe that this guy that saw this thing on guard probably saw about the same thing I did, and I do believe when they told him it was something in the inventory, I think it was. Especially now that I've heard somebody else see something like I did. It's been many years, and all I've ever been is laughed at for the story and kidded about the super soldier, And I really believe now that you are talking about something that was in the inventory at one time.
That's a very interesting point, and we appreciate that much, Louis. And Leonard will get in touch with you and go into further detail with a little later, okay?
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you very much for calling. KABC Times, 22 minutes of midnight. Things. However, Louis just said it may not have been that a minute ago. Let's go to another caller. KABC, you're on Open Mind with Bill Jenkins. Hello.
My name is Chuck.
Chuck?
And I'm a member of a group called 311 Group. It's a newly formed group. It's a private group that is doing investigation on extraterrestrials and UFO landings, too. And I've been listening to your show tonight, and we're talking about all the UFOs that have crashed. And a question that comes up in our conversation is, if all these UFOs are crashing, and we have records of all of them, well, the big question is, how many of the UFOs have actually landed? I listened to the show a couple of weeks ago, and we had some people talking about the Pleiades people, people that were already here among us.
Yes, sir.
And I was just wondering if this man from the group Ray, if he has any documentation of actual landings, not just the crashes, but landings and the extraterrestrials getting out.
Did we touch on that a minute ago, Leonard, about the incident at Nellis Air Force Base?
I didn't hear that. I hear you.
Well, this was Chuck calling, and he is involved in these things, and he wanted to know if you had any incidents or...
Of landings,
yeah.
Oh, yes. These are too numerous to mention. We have those by the thousands. That is going all the way back to World War II. These are getting, they're getting about as common as the first encounters of the third kind, and, we now have 2,000 reports, mind you, logged on close encounters of the third kind. That's the encounter with the entities and landed craft.
I think Wendell, you could add something to that there, couldn't you?
I'm sure that Wendell can.
An interesting thing, since the book got distributed and got around a little bit, a lot more people have contacted us to tell us about their personal experiences. And the thing that's most baffling is the amount of contact that's going on that is unreported. Since the last time I talked to you, Bill, I picked up 4 new cases that involve extensive contact that is kept pretty much quiet in a local group of people, usually a family or very close friends. One lady has written down over 200,000 words of notes on the contacts and the experiences. Now that's a lot of notes. That's over 1,000 type pages of notes.
Where are these people from?
I don't remember where she said they came from. She's working directly with Dr. Leo Sprinkle at the moment, though, and she's joining in here in about a week for some more hypnotic regression to try to find out how and when a device was implanted in her head, which they used to contact her and maintain a regular communication.
Does that help answer your question, Chuck?
It does, but within a crash situation, we have actual pieces of metal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for concrete evidence of actual landing. They're like burn marks on the ground, maybe,
those are all over.
They're all over.
Yeah,
they're okay. Everywhere. Worldwide. Okay, well, what's the report on the movie? We'll be doing our research too then.
Yeah, so, if you have a chance to pick up a book, called UFO Reports from Flying Saucer Review. It's possibly maybe out of print, but probably available at your library. And there are thousands and thousands of cases there of landing, as well as Mr. Greenfield's book, Situation Red, the UFO Thief.
Also, Chuck, I might tell you that I'm trying to get a gentleman on the show in a couple of weeks, if I can write him down, who's going to talk about the different structures that are on the moon right now. And that's quite fascinating, too.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
KABC time is 15 minutes of midnight. Those crashed UFOs is also on board, and we're ready to take more of your questions. KABC, you're on with Bill Jenkins.
Hi, this is Homer.
Hello, Homer.
Have you ever taken any of this flying saucer material and put it on an spectrograph or put it in an X-ray analysis machine to determine the structure?
You're not coming in clear there, Homer. What was the question again?
Have you ever taken any of this flying saucer material and put it on a mass spectrograph to determine its elements, or put it on an X-ray diffraction machine to determine its molecular structure?
Okay. Has testing been done of material from the crash disk? I think is Homer's main question there, Larry.
I couldn't hear the question.
Well, he wanted to know if you have any of the results of any of the testing that's been done on the material that was found in the...
That is one area. When you get into the technical area of the crashed craft, why, that's a pretty sensitive area. It is easier, from my experience, getting information about the internal anatomy on the bodies than it is getting technical information concerning the craft. This is one area that is really super sensitive. And as far as the getting any, any clear information, precise information concerning the propulsion system or the metals or anti-gravity or the cybernetics or whatever, that is most difficult. These people are under the tightest degree of secrecy, and there's no way that they will reveal anything without having some kind of punitive action taken. So this is one area, too, that I'm very careful of. With the information that I have, in certain informants, I've been told to be very, very careful with it, and that I could get in trouble myself. So I have to be very careful how they answer that.
Did you say something about the occupants, then?
Yeah, we discussed those a little earlier.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, they're little people generally, about 4 or 4.5 feet tall, and humanoid in shape, primarily. Although they don't look exactly like us, the ones that have been retrieved so far as we can tell. Is that about correct, Hunter?
I was wondering about their body chemistry.
Excuse me, Homer?
I was wondering about their body chemistry. Anything on that?
Maybe you can touch on that quickly again, Leonard, and we got to run.
On the body?
Yeah, the body chemistry.
They're about average 4 feet tall. They weigh around 40 pounds. The head is very large. If you could view what a five-month human fetus would look like by going to any of your museums, you might check on that. But there's four fingers, no thumb, webbing effect between each finger. The skin is not green, it's grayish color. There is no hair on the head or body. There's no GI tract, the mouth. There's only a slit that leads to nowhere. There's no digestive tract. There is a liquid in the body, which does not have red cells, no lymphocytes, and there's much more. But the best way to get all the information, I have quite a bit, is to order the paper itself, Fetus Report Number 2, which costs $5 by mailing it to the Mutual UFO Network or MUFON, M-U-F-O-N, at 103 Old Town Road. One word, Old Town, in Seguin, Texas, S-E-G-U-I-N, zip code 78155. Now, in there, I have several pages of anatomical description of the body, external, internal, and also drawings.
Okay, Homer? Listen, we were cramped for time here, Homer, and I'm going to have to run on that one, and we'll get right back to our questions in just a moment.
Yes, tonight.
We're going to have to do it again because we just touched the tip of the iceberg.
We just scratched the surface, really. There's so much to relate, and I'm the first one to admit it is a very incredible story, and I feel very privileged to have the information that I have, and I hope that I'm using it correctly. I do believe the public should have this information. I think that's a must, and I'll do everything I can to impart information.
And if anybody does feel like they want to talk to you, Leonard, they can contact me.
I want you to get my address over the phone, if it's permissible or advisable. If anyone wishes to impart information on a very confidential basis, I'd be willing to relate to them on that basis. And I am reachable at 4412 Grove Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45227. To be very frank, I'm not interested in researching lights in the sky anymore. There's nothing, no way we can resolve those. It's like beating a dead horse. But I am concerned. I narrowed down my research to UFO crash retrievals. And anyone that wishes to impart information on a confidential basis, I'll be delighted to receive it and to exchange information with you.
Bill, can I ask Mr. Stevens a quick question?
We gotta make it real quick, David.
Mr. Stevens, you're noted for a very famous photograph that was taken in Canada. I'd just like briefly to, maybe you can relate what went through your mind when you saw this.
Which photograph are you talking about, sir?
The one that was taken in Canada.
Near Calgary?
Yes, sir.
At Highwood Ranger Station?
Yes, sir.
I'm very impressed with the photographs. Those have never been disputed. They've been checked by computers, and they stand the testing. They seem to be legitimate photographs.
Hey, listen, I'm going to let you two talk off the air, if you don't mind, because our time has just run out. Wendell, I'm so happy that you joined us. David, you too. We'll see you next week on KABC's Open Mind.
Hey.